This is audiobook in MP3, in half-hour parts of The Truth About Mars, by Ernest L. Norman. From 1956. The preface and book were written in May of 1955. Preface. A few months ago the astronomical and astrophysical world was tremendously excited by the approaching conjunction of the Earth with the planet Mars. This article being written in May 1955, refers to the conjunction of Mars with the Earth at the turn of the year 1954 to 1955. Many prominent astronomical authorities hope to settle once and for all time the old controversial issues about this planet, that is, were there canals or were there not canals on Mars, and was this planet inhabited by some form of man. So far as can be ascertained, the results of these investigations, after thousands of photographs of the planet and numerous controversies, was that some groups were even more firmly entrenched in their original ideas, while others became more confused than ever. In an overall sense, it can be said that they arrived at no definite conclusion whatever, nor will any new conclusions that may be arrived at have, by the same token, any more validity than the original concepts. See addenda. Therefore, any new attempt at visualizing life or the canals on Mars resolves into the realm of clairvoyance and not by the making of bigger and more powerful telescopes. The 200-inch telescope at PT Palomar has, in a sense, merely increased the size of the universe for man rather than brought it closer to him. Now, just in case the term clairvoyant should arouse any antagonism or question in some persons, let us digress a moment to explain just what is meant by the word clairvoyance. Clairvoyance, or the development of the sixth sense, is only another word for extrasensory perception taking place within the consciousness of man rather than through the reactionary physical senses such as physical sight, hearing, smell, touch and taste. Practically everyone on this earth has had or will, at some time, be in a semi or momentarily clairvoyant state. Anyone having a so-called hunch or premonition is momentarily in such a state. At the Great Duke University, Dr. Ryan, in his 50 years of research on parapsychology, has definitely established the facts and truths of extrasensory perception. There are numerous societies, associations and organizations, national and international, whose many years of work have proven beyond a doubt that man does have, and can also develop, this extra sense or clairvoyance, sometimes called the sixth sense. Any doubting Thomas can, if he is open-minded enough, find in a short time, an overwhelming mass of evidence to support this truth. In an advanced state of clairvoyance, an individual sees and lives in a state of consciousness which tunes him in, as it were, to past or future events, places and happenings, distance being no barrier. Such an awareness or consciousness is almost as real as the everyday objects around him. Any particular electrical or mechanical device, such as the television set, will demonstrate to some extent the nature of this conception. A savage in the jungle would immediately be confounded were he presented with the appearance of some of our everyday appliances. He would quite likely, in his failure to understand or conceive, throw up his hands and deny the whole thing. He would, in a sense, be like the farmer who saw the giraffe for the first time, exclaiming that there is no such animal. It is, as it has always been, the great lack of ability to form new concepts which has always caused man to throw up his hands, and cry out loudly against the appearance of any new thought, or mechanical or electrical contrivance. This is also quite true of most of our modern-day scientists, whether he is a man of medicine, of chemistry or of astronomy. Therefore it is up to individuals who have developed this extra sense or clairvoyance, to fill in the obvious gaps in our many branches of science as well as in some of the more firmly established spiritual concepts. In writing an article of this kind, no effort is being made to prove what I have found and believe is true. Truth is entirely independent of the individual. After my 35 years of active research in the fields of electronics, physics, astrophysics, parapsychology and their allied and associated sciences, I have succeeded in correlating and establishing an integrated concept, which when combined with a natural and highly developed clairvoyance gives, to a practically perfect degree, a direct mental contact not only with person to person upon this earth, but in contacting individuals living on other planets. This is in a sense, what can be called conscious astral flight, inasmuch as I see the cities and the people and hear the individuals, as they now exist on other planets. No mechanical devices are used, nor is any particularly advanced degree of trance state entered into, maintaining conscious continuity and being able to quote at the time, just what is taking place both audibly and visibly, at all times. The truth about Mars. Since the dawn of time and the beginning of man's history on this planet, the starry skies have always been something of not only great and wondrous beauty, but also filled with mystery and awe. The histories of the ancient times contain numerous references to the sun, the moon and the many bright stars and planets. Man has worshipped these heavenly bodies as deities or gods. Quite often the very nature of the religious beliefs of the peoples were woven around these mystical heavenly orbs. Naturally, there has been a great deal of conjecture as to life and the existence of man in some form on some of these bright specks of light. This is especially true of the moon and of the planets of our solar system. Men like Copernicus, Galileo, Plato, etc., all speculated on this possibility. During the last 25 years or so, there has been a tremendous impetus given to astronomical interests. Perhaps this is partly due to the approach of the conclusion of a great cycle and the actual beginning of the Aquarian Age. There are numerous monthly publications which deal in a fictional way with interplanetary travel and life on other planets. There likewise are other articles and stories which have appeared from time to time dealing with flying saucers and spaceships, etc., which claim to be true, and as a small lad I shared this common interest in the heavens. Often I would peer through my father's telescope, which was of very modest power, at the moon or other bright points of interest. Winter nights would often be devoted to poring over any book or article containing anything of astronomical nature. It was not, however, until the close of World War II and the sudden influx of flying saucer stories, that time and circumstances permitted resuming this fascinating subject. Along with metaphysical work which I did both in churches and independently, the planets, space travel, etc., all became an integrated part of this work. It was inevitable that sooner or later I should actually take a flight to some planet, not that this would be done in a rocket or some such machine. Man has not progressed to such an advanced state of engineering as yet. So any such trips would be in a clairvoyant state. I am not the only one by far, who has had such experiences. The persons both known and unknown who have made such flights and contacts are too numerous to mention at this time. I might add that much of what is written in the following pages has since been corroborated by some of these persons, without my previously having read any articles so written by them. It has been my consistent habit to spend an hour or so of the late evening time in meditation. During these hours I have made innumerable contacts with those who have passed from this plane of existence. However, no serious attempt at interplanetary contact was tried until the second month of the year of 1955. At that time I began to be increasingly aware that something like this was being attempted by the peoples of other planets. One evening, about the first part of May, of this year, while in a deep meditative state, I suddenly perceived a rather strange-looking man standing before me. At first I thought him to be Chinese, as his dress and general appearance was somewhat similar to that of a man of ancient China. After introducing himself as Narelle, however, he quickly explained that he was from the planet Mars, and that if I so desired, I could go there with him, to his city, in astral flight, and that he would be my personal guide. He explained that his people were very desirous, in view of all the controversy going on, to clear up some of the so-called mysteries of Mars. He further assured me that it was quite obvious that a complete understanding was not possible in one visitation, therefore as the first contact was made, it would be comparatively easy to establish other contacts, as was convenient and necessary. Since this first contact and trip was made, I have returned on several occasions, in fact, Nureyev stood beside me as I wrote, to further clear up or refresh my memory regarding any details which were not entirely clear. Now I will contact my Martian guide and take an astral flight through space, and see just how it is that man lives on the Red Planet. Almost immediately a very distinguished looking man stands before me. He is Nureyev, a man of high position and esteem from one of the Martian cities. He is dressed in a very brilliant red suit. The coat is long, almost to the knees, with loose-fitting pantaloons. On his head is a red hat with a square-shaped brim that is turned up on four sides. Our trip there is a matter of split seconds as no craft is used or needed. Arriving on the surface of Mars, we are at once aware of the extremely rugged terrain, rocky hills and sandy wastes, that stretches out endlessly around us. There are many peculiar whirling dust clouds all about. Nureyev explains that the ionosphere is very thin, which leaves the surface almost unprotected from the various beta, gamma and cosmic rays. This high concentration of rays ionizes the very rare and gaseous atmosphere and, together with thermal currents, creates terrific dust storms. There is also a very thinly divided dust layer on the ionosphere which helps create the reddish appearance of the planet. There are also a number of volcanoes, three of which are of major size. One of these was just barely visible on the horizon, trailing a thin wisp of smoke from its truncated cone. It was also explained that as Mars has only 7 degrees axis inclination, there is not much of a seasonal change. Water is very scarce on this arid planet. Most of the precipitation falls at the poles. Vegetation is also scarce. There are a few varieties of prickly cacti-looking plants. Also near the polar ice caps, grows a very luxuriant green alga-like plant that follows the melting snow line. This spongy growth often attains a height, or depth, of 40 to 50 feet. It appears and disappears with the season as it grows tremendously rapidly, and it also disintegrates very fast. There are also a number of species of lizards, reptiles and of some insects whose hard shells have enabled them to weather the extreme atmospheric conditions, and among them are giant ants which walk semi-erect on the two hind feet. The guide tells me these are mutants which were accidentally produced from a small ant in an atomic experiment ages ago. They are similar to humans in a very low state of intelligence, and at one time it became necessary to make war on them, as they became so numerous and large. These strange ant creatures average 2 to 4 feet in height and live in rocky caves. But we did not tarry long on the surface. I followed my guide to a rather strange-looking rock. Then, taking a small whistle from his coat pocket, he blew one note, and although I heard nothing, the rock immediately swung open, disclosing a car-like elevator. We entered and, after the door closed, I had the familiar dropping sensation of our own modern elevators. The trip down took but a few seconds, and, upon stopping, I stepped forth into what was my first glimpse of a Martian city. I was immediately impressed by the soft white light that seemed to come from everywhere. We were standing near the entrance of a large tube. On Mars, the cities are all underground and are connected together by huge oval metal tubes from 300 to 500 feet in diameter. There are monorail cars as long as our Pullman trains which glide silently and very swiftly from one city to another. The bottoms of these immense tubes are used for parks, growing foodstuffs and innumerable small manufacturing plants. Because of the great distances between the cities, these tubes have been built only partially submerged. There are emergency airlocks and bulkheads at the ends where they connect to the domes. Other safety and precautionary measures are used to protect the cities and tunnels in case of breakdowns or outside attack. It is these tubes which have confused the astronomers on the Earth. Some believe them to be canals. There are also other theories. The shifting desert sands often cover or uncover them, which leads to further confusion inasmuch as they seem to appear and disappear. Turning about and looking down into the city is an unforgettable experience. Like all cities on Mars, it is built on the floor of a huge metal dome. These domes are sometimes 4 or 5 miles in diameter, and up to 3,000 feet high. They are constructed of huge curved trusses of a whitish metal, seemingly of a magnesium compound. These trusses are covered with a metal top and bottom, and the space in between filled with a plastic foam similar to the construction of the houses. This also gives added protection from the various cosmic rays as well as sealing in the precious air supply. Underneath the roof is an inner shell or a second false shell, which is composed of sheets of a pale blue plastic. This is suspended from brackets from the dome at a distance of about 6 feet. In this space are the many thousands of fluorescent tubes which make up the lighting system, and they reflect downward the soft radiant light which I first noticed. I was told this light is very similar to a modified sunlight, and is very healthful and stimulating to plant life, as well as to the people. As these domes are built in the bottom of excavations, the sands soon drift over them and cover them up, giving added protection from the strong surface rays. The cities are laid out like a wheel. The center hub is a very large circular structure which houses the various municipal and civic governmental departments. Underground is a very large atomic power plant for supplying the city's needs. The streets stretch away from the hub like spokes, and at regular intervals circular streets are intersected. This is similar to our national capital. The streets which radiate from the hub rise at a very gentle rate of inclination. The houses and other buildings are built on low elevations which rise like tiers. Walking up one of these streets gives one the impression of walking on air, as the paving is of a springy plastic material in a very soft shade of green. Stopping to inspect some of the houses, I am nearly overwhelmed by their wondrous beauty, simplicity and charm. In every small, vacant space in the streets and grounds around the houses are growing plants. These are mostly fruits and vegetables. They are planted in metal troughs and other containers. The soil is a mixture of natural and artificial plant humus and moss. The houses and buildings are semi-prefabricated in a wide variety of plastic of pastel shades. The walls are formed of two sheets of thin plastic about 2 inches apart. After the walls are fastened together, a liquid foam-like plastic material is injected or blown in between the walls. After this hardens, it gives the whole structure tremendous strength. This hardened plastic foam acts also as a good insulator. There is no problem of heat or cold in a Martian city, with an abundance of atomic power. The whole city is air-conditioned, free from dust and fumes, and is maintained at a constant temperature of about 68 degrees. Further comfort is assured the occupants of each home by its own air conditioner. Huge electronic pumps suck in and filter the thin outside air and raise the pressure to about 7 pounds per square inch. This is somewhat of the same way in which a modern Earth airliner pressurizes the passenger cabins. It also strengthens the overhead dome structure by pushing out uniformly at all points simultaneously. As the outside atmosphere is very rare and of a low oxygen content, the Martian cities are becoming less and less dependent on that source of air supply. Many thousands of years ago they learned how to obtain air from water by electrolysis. They also make a great effort to create great underground reservoirs near the ice caps to drain off and store any surplus surface water, which also, along with the oxygen, has become increasingly rare through the centuries. At the present time, scientists on Mars are learning to make air and water synthetically out of other elements. They have also explored every possible existing subterranean river or lake and have added much to the dwindling water supply by some important discoveries. It is estimated that, with careful conservation, they will have enough water for several thousand years, during which time other means will have been arrived at for solving this problem. Mars is very rich in mineral deposits, of which some of the radioactive variety are especially abundant. The planet has also, like the Earth, a molten liquid core of some of the more dense elements. Scientists on Mars are tapping these deep fiery realms as an extra or added power supply, although the abundant radioactive elements are at present more than adequate to supply all the needs. All buildings are supplied with electric power from the central power plant. The power is radiated over ultra-high frequency beams which crisscross the streets, and are relayed by smaller substations. On top of each building is a split ball-like antenna which intercepts these power beams, bringing power down onto a small secondary radiator which in turn radiates the power through the building, lighting the lights, operating the various motors, etc. These are, of course, all constructed very differently than the motors and electric lights on Earth, which are large, clumsy and very inefficient by comparison. View of a street in one of the Martian underground cities inside the metal tubes which the astronomer takes to be canals. Window glass is a polarized material which transmits light one way, from outside in, which gives privacy without the problem of shade and drapes. A simple metal folding shutter is sometimes drawn across the window to shut out the light when sleeping, etc. Furniture in the home is very simple and is contoured to the body and is made of metal and plastic. The houses are not overly furnished as are so many of Earth homes, yet there is sufficient for comfort in a simple fashion. Rugs are a plastic foam-like material which is springy and resilient with no dusty nap. Various colors are used and slightly raised designs which give variety and charm to the lovely overall appearance. The kitchens would be a delight to the Earth woman. All cooking is done in an oven which is built in a wall cabinet. The oven is operated on high frequencies which cook all foods in a matter of a very few minutes, or in most cases only a few seconds. There is a dial-like indicator which is preset. The food to be cooked is placed in the oven, the door closed, a red light flashes, and presto, the meal is cooked. I did not see any boiling or frying, in the conventional way. After dinner, the dishwashing is a very quick and simple process. The dishes are placed in a metal cabinet, a dial set, and after a few minutes all are clean and sparkling, no water is used. Instead, stream of electronic energy of some sort does the job. The dishes are made of a plastic-like material which is repellent to soil. The bathroom is also quite different. The stool appears or disappears in the wall as needed. Disposal is efficiently taken care of by electrolysis. Very little water apparently is used. Bathing is done in a small booth where an atomized spray of pleasant-smelling liquid is sprayed on the body and wiped off with a very absorbent towel. Here also, no water is used. There is also some kind of energy ray used which stimulates and leaves the body very refreshed. Teeth are cleaned with a sort of electronic brush which is a metal rod on a handle. Moving it around the teeth directs a flow of energy which cleans and stimulates the teeth and gums. Very little of the normally expected house cleaning is done in a Martian home. All interior surfaces are dirty repellent and, as the air is normally very clean and inasmuch as there is no smoking, frying or similar soot procedures, the homes are very clean and spotless. Mounting a flight of stairs to the roof, we emerge onto a typical Martian garden. The roofs of these homes are flat and planted with a wide variety of fruits, vegetables and flowers. Each home grows quite a lot of the normal supply of foodstuff it consumes. They take great pride in these roof gardens and frequently engage in friendly competition in contests between neighbors in an attempt to raise the most beautiful display of horticulture. Returning to the street after my first glimpse into a Martian home, I became aware that there was something missing which was customarily found in a city. Glancing up and down the street, it suddenly occurred to me. There were no stores, no shops, no neon signs or any of the familiar garishness one finds in our cities. My bewilderment caused Narelle to smile. Motioning me to following, he walked over to where a low, circular platform stood, up a few inches from the street level. We stepped on this platform and almost immediately began a slow descent through a metal tube. On coming to rest, a door opened and we stepped out into what was another great surprise. Now I understood why the streets slanted up and the lack of stores and commercial buildings, for here stretched out before me was a huge shopping center, which in some odd way reminded me of one of our annual state fairs. Up and down and around were streets and aisles with shops and booths displaying the many articles of clothing and food familiar to the Martian way of life. There was, however, noticeable differences. Little or no advertising was used. The shop owner sat or stood quietly by or worked on various articles he, or she, sold. A quaint system of barter and exchange is generally prevalent, although some form of script, currently similar to a department store charge plate, is also used. Martians are inherently honest, stealing is almost unknown. Consequently, there is no need to accumulate more than is needed, for they do not have the fear of insecurity. There is no price haggling over various transactions. Some sections have mechanical automat-like dispensers in which a key charge plate is inserted and withdrawn after the article is discharged. Another curious feature of these marketplaces are the escalator sidewalks. On several of the main thoroughfares were double tracks, one coming and one going, with a small bench-like seat to sit on. A person merely stepped on, sat down and was moved slowly up and down in front of the various stalls or shops. Everywhere I turned to look, I saw happy, smiling faces with none of that taut, drawn look that is so prevalent in our cities. I was informed that there are several of these centers, which are regularly interspersed around the circumference of the cities and located in the space formed by the floor of the dome and the rural sections above. In between these market centers, much space is devoted to the cultivation of various crops, one of which is a grain very similar to millet. There is also a species of rice which grows with very little moisture. It seems that many of these plant crops have been evolved through a Burbank-like process to a point where they require the absolute minimum of water. No heavy manufacturing is done in these cities, but there are several domes which are devoted to, and used almost exclusively for, this type of work. But time was slipping by, and reluctantly I followed my guide to another elevator and we ascended back to the main level. As we walked along one of the streets, I could not help but feel overawed by the beauty of all the things around me, the lovely homes and roof gardens, the landscaped parkways growing lush with fruits and flowers, the peace and quiet which was everywhere. I looked curiously at some of those who were passing by, although I do not believe they could see me in my astral state. At least if they did so, they gave no indication that they were being rudely stared at, and I assumed their smiles and greetings were meant for Narelle. I did not see any indication of the use of any cosmetics on the women's faces. Their eyes were quite large and black with a distinct slant, the skin was wax-like and beautifully colored, lips red and well-shaped, which in all left nothing to be desired in any external adornment. There are other things which were noticeable by their absence. There is no smoking, the use of tobacco being unheard of. Narelle chuckled when I asked about this, stating that such a practice was grown-up thumb-sucking and was a habit belonging only to those who were not completely weaned. The drinking of alcoholic beverages is also unknown, so there were none of the familiar taverns or liquor houses. No doubt many of the Earthians would be lost on Mars without their familiar daily and hourly inhalations and libations of pap and bellywash. The people of Mars are smaller than those on Earth, only averaging about 4 feet 6 inches in height. They are somewhat Mongolian in appearance. The texture of the skin is very fine and soft, while the hair is usually straight, black, and quite fine. The men do not need to shave, for they have eradicated electronically the growth of hair from their faces when still young. Martians are much older in soul evolution than the Earthians. They originally migrated in spacecraft to Mars from a dying planet more than a million years ago. They also came to this Earth and started a colony but found it impractical to maintain. It was also explained by Narelle that this colony became our Chinese race through the evolution of time. The Martians are a quiet, peace-loving people. Their clothing is simple with long loose flowing lines, with nothing to bind them, in many brilliant colors including many shades we know not. All clothing is made of synthetic materials as no natural fibers are grown. Talking as we walked along, we soon came to the end of the street where it joined the center hub. Before us was a very imposing structure which formed part of the circular center section. As we entered, I immediately became aware that it was some kind of laboratory. Various strange chemical odors were faintly discernible. We were met at the door by another Martian named Uzak. He was dressed in a bright yellow clock or smock with a large blue circle with a cross in the center, embroidered on the right side of the breast, which denoted his rank as a head scientist. After introductions, he took us in tow and we proceeded to make a tour of this great laboratory. The first section we entered was devoted to research, Uzak explained. His science was very much advanced compared to that of Earth. On Mars, the scientists know how to create and grow live tissue as well as plant chlorophyll. This is done by an elaborate process which involves the use of certain kinds of life-creating radiations or energy streams.